Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, South Africa mourns constitutional architect and global diplomat Nicholas Fink-Haysom. Our water crisis is deepening as skill shortages and weak leadership have systems failing. Anger is growing over a renewed push to liquidate the South African Post Office, and 9 in 10 South African children are missing out on critical mental health care. It's Friday, the 20th of March. Now, this week, the world is mourning the loss of one of South Africa's great legal minds and quiet architects of democracy. Nicholas Fink-Haysom has died at the age of just 73. He was a man who helped shape South Africa's constitution alongside Nelson Mandela and then went on to play a pivotal role in peace processes across some of the world's most fragile states. Tributes have poured in from the United Nations and leaders here at home describing a life devoted to justice, to reconciliation and human rights. And I want to reflect on his life, his legacy and what all of this means for South Africa today. And a prominent former politician, trade unionist and activist Jay Naidu is with me. Jay, a very warm welcome. In simple terms, what did the country lose this week?
I think it lost a patriot whose consistency and continuity of integrity was visible to all of us across the arc of his life. And so, you know, I met Fink and Marianne, who he was living with, and they had a family in 1979, you know, when the South Africa was burning with repression, but also the possibility that we could reach agreement and find common ground, unlike countries we know in the world today. And I think that in the context of having come through the struggle with the murder of, you know, Steve Biko, I was part of the Black Consciousness Movement. You know, it was the first time I met white people who treated me as a comrade. Mm. You know, this was Fink-Haysom and Marianne, they, you know, they sort of helped me understand things in a way that, you know, may encourage me to become the trade union leader I became. So they were very important in that early stage when I was grappling with how to articulate the political struggle I wanted to be part of. So I think Fink, you know, and then later, you know, when I became the General Secretary of COSATU and was elected into that position, I mean, Cheadle Thompson and Haysom, the Haysom part of it, was there, like almost my back office when we were, you know, we had COSATU house bombed. We had these massive strikes, the mine workers strikes, the OK bazaars, the railway strike. I mean, practically, they were on call 24 hours a day. And he did the same when he went to United Nations. And the thing that, you know, I've spoken to people that work with him in his work as a peace, you know, envoy of the United Nations General Secretary, you know, everyone recognized his humanity. His every pore and cell in his body spoke the language of justice, of communication, of finding common ground, of rising above the constituencies and finding that common ground. And he was brilliant in that role because it took something that I think Mandela in his magical way was able to do. You felt comfortable, you felt safe with him, that there was integrity there. And I think this is the thing I remember.
Jay, one of the unsung architects, no doubt, of our democracy. Explain to us how influential he really was in shaping the constitution that we live under today.
Well, you know, In the early days of CODESA, of course, I had made the decision had been made for me that I should stay out of the negotiations and hold the fort as the General Secretary of COSATU. But Fink was instrumental, you know, in how we would interpret many, you know, because he was already in the country as we were going through the 70s and 80s and already active in that, active as a student activist, and then in USAS, and then the early intellectuals, white intellectuals who supported the growth of a new militant trade union movement that eventually became COSATU. So all of these were shaped, but he had an uncanny ability to be able to find what was, you know, precious in how we would weave together. So he could sit with workers and shop stewards, but he could sit with some of the world's greatest constitutional lawyers, and he could orchestrate a conversation between those two. And I think that's a remarkable ability that not many leaders have. So I think that, you know, Fink was always the guy at the back, in the back rooms. He was the one that was a quiet diplomat that was, you know, walking the corridors of power, but also walking the streets where war was being waged against innocent people. And he could be the bridge between the two worlds.
And in that respect, as you've referenced, he spent years in global conflict zones. I wonder, J. Naidu, what that says about South Africa's intellectual export to the world.
We have a brain's trust, not just in politics and in peacekeeping and in development of social justice or the philosophy of Ubuntu that Mandela represents. But if you go to every sector of South Africa's economy, we have the best engineers in the world. We have created such amazing innovations that the world takes for granted, ATM machines, the CAT scan. I mean, we really undermine ourselves as South Africans, you know. And I think today, in a world that is falling apart, you know, Jeremy, we as South Africans need to rise to the occasion, because we are the example of a country that rose from the ashes of conflict and war, found the common ground, and still continue to be a political miracle in spite of all the problems we have. And I think this is an urgent call to all South Africans, that we should recognize that we're standing on the shoulders of very powerful ancestors, and Fink is the one of the latest ancestors, and they are urging us, black and white people, to sit down today and stop throwing missiles at each other and political verbiage, and start to find solutions at a grassroots level. This is the message of Fink. This is my message, that 65 million Americans cannot allow ourselves to be bulldozed into the ground by people who are corrupt. We cannot allow it, and we cannot allow political partners to play cannon fodder with our people. I think this is a wake-up call for South Africans. There are many generations that have sacrificed their lives, including Fink, including Steve Biko or Chris Hani or Mandela himself, that paid with their lives for this freedom that we enjoy. And why should we allow anyone, whether they're in business or government or NGOs or trade unions, to continue to bedevil the dream that was born in 1994? This is my appeal and prayer to 65 million South Africans. We've had enough.
Reflecting on the life of Nicholas Fink-Haysom and the state of South Africa right now, J. Naidu, former trade unionist cabinet minister, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's water crisis, I would contend, is no longer just about failing pipes and aging infrastructure. It is increasingly, from what I read, about a collapse in skills, in leadership, and also accountability. And as so-called National Water Week approaches, it's going to put a real sharp spotlight on the sector. And let me tell you, the numbers are stark. Municipalities are losing nearly half of all treated water through leaks, through theft and inefficiency, while many simply don't have the technical or managerial capacity to fix the problem. So is this now less an infrastructure crisis and more a human capital failure? This is an important issue, and I'm going to discuss it with Dr. Lester Goldman, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa. Lester, a very warm welcome to you. Just call it bluntly for me. Are we facing a water crisis, or is it a leadership crisis?
I think it's both. You know, the fact of the matter is that water is a business, and like any business, it cannot succeed without having the right people in place. And the people include leadership, unfortunately, or fortunately. And I think that's the dilemma, because at municipal level, we sit with issues where the value chain in those leadership decisions is pretty long, and it goes beyond just the technical individuals. So whilst we need the technical individuals, we also need those in leadership and management to play their part. And that is where the dilemma exists mainly.
And that's the real problem, if I'm hearing you correctly. We might have the skills, but fundamentally, yes, this comes down to real, tangible accountability, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, running a municipality is like running a company. So we have pipes and pumps, for example, that are almost like the machines. We have engineers, scientists, and operators that are the staff from a technical perspective. We have audits, which are almost the reviews. And these audits, Blue Drop, Green Drop, and No Drop, actually starts sometime in April. So it's a particularly relevant period for municipalities to consider these now. And then we have the communities who are the customers. And I think the current problem is, as you've stated, almost half of our treated water is lost. Then we have municipalities that fail Blue Drop, Green Drop audits, and customers who are losing confidence in the supply of water. So we need more accountability, and we need accountability at all levels, because it doesn't matter how much we invest in infrastructure. Without having the right people in place, we are still facing an even bigger problem.
You've just quoted or used a statistic which I find utterly staggering. Nearly half of treated water is lost. Dr. Goldman, explain to me how a system deteriorates so quickly, if it is a question of speed, and to that extent.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors, and it's obviously very localized depending on the municipality, or depending upon the available infrastructure. But we understand that over time, very much like a car or any other system, it requires continuous maintenance, it requires operational investment, and then also we need further investment in reticulation, for example. So when there's this lack of maintenance, obviously, over time, the infrastructure erodes and eventually fails. And when this happens, we have this break-in interruption of water. And this, let's call it lack of O&M, operations and maintenance, is as a result of maybe a few factors. Do you have the right people? Do you have the right processes? And then do you have the correct investment? So this is the challenge faced. We're not so sure that the human element is dealt with, because we're not so sure that we have the competent people. And even if we had them in place, we're not so sure that they've been held to account. But if you had the right people and you had the right infrastructure, and you add the right money or investment, then at least we can tackle this problem logistically and holistically.
Isn't it fundamentally all about the money? You suggest that funding isn't enough. Where, yes, along that value chain do you think the system is actually breaking down?
I think, you know, if we look at water as a business and you look at the municipality as a business, then it's going to come down to... And if we're talking about money and the entire value chain, it will come down to, are the municipalities doing what they are supposed to? And the money business is, or the water business is, a one of, you get your bulk water from the bulk water suppliers like the water boards, and you pay them for that, and you on-sell that to your customers, and you collect the money. Along the way, you reduce your inefficiencies and losses. You know, so that you can come out with a reasonable a break even. And that's really where the challenge lies. I'm not so sure that the revenue systems are working. I'm not so sure that if they are working, that money is being collected. And then you have this cascading a scenario of bad effects, because if you're not collecting that money, you can't maintain the infrastructure, you can't pay your suppliers, and so forth. And it's very much like a car that hasn't been serviced. It will eventually fail and collapse.
And just finally, if we don't get this right, and you've identified the three core pillars here, how bad is it going to get in the next 5 years or so?
Well, we hope we won't get there. But certainly governance failure is something that should be addressed by municipalities and those tasked with assisting the municipalities. So COCTA and the relevant government departments needs to play their part in ensuring that municipalities can improve and that they do improve. So there's governance failures, there's maintenance neglect. So I would argue that that's where we'd come in that you need to have the right competent professionals in place, because the professionals are meet a certain standard and they are held independently to account. So you need to have the right people in place, you need to hold them to account, and then certainly you need to have the correct financial management. And that goes across a number of value chains within the municipality itself, not just the technical department, but finance, HR, and leadership, which is the councillors. They must play their part and hold hands in solving this challenge. And then obviously over the next 5 years, well, the audits are taking place in the next 2 weeks. The audit results will be there towards the end of the year. And the nice thing with audits and or measures is that at least if you can measure it, you can manage it. And if we know where we are, we can, along with stakeholders, work on a success plan going forward or not work on it, whichever way.
Thank you very much indeed. We can't say we haven't been warned. Dr. Lester Goldman, Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
The South African Post Office is once again staring down the barrel of liquidation, with business rescue efforts faltering, funding shortfalls mounting, and thousands of jobs on the line. The trade union federation COSATU has come out strongly against any move to shut it down, warning of devastating social and economic consequences. But with no clear turnaround plan in sight, I think the question is whether resistance is actually enough. Let's put all of that to Matthew Parks, Parliamentary Coordinator at COSATU. Matthew, welcome. First of all, how real is the threat of liquidation right now? Is this imminent or do you think it's avoidable?
We think it's both. The business rescue practitioners, the administrators, appointed by the court in 2023, have threatened to take the post office back to court to liquidate it because of its outstanding debt and because of a lack of financial support from the state. But we think it is avoidable. The administrators seem to be kind of backtracking from the threats. We hope that it was just a bluff on their part. But I think for us, the fundamental issue is that the post office is still in ICU. It's struggling. There's a lack of a clear turnaround plan being implemented. There's a need for the state to honor its commitments to giving some financial support in exchange for a turnaround plan. But we think it can be fixed, and I think we are given comfort and heart that we've seen other state-owned enterprises being rescued from the graveyard or the ICU, whether it's Eskom or Transnet, whether it's Metrorail or South African Airways. And it just shows you, if you appoint competent management, if you remove corrupt and criminal elements, if you fill critical vacancies and hire the right skills, you invest in the infrastructure of the institution with a bit of financial support to get us off its feet, you can rebuild these institutions. But the Post Bank, its twin, need to have a new business model. You know, Jeremy, you can't do what we used to do when we were, you know, slightly younger, posting letters to grandparents. It's not going to work. You send an email or WhatsApp these days. But, you know, there is a space. The post office needs to enter the very lucrative courier space. That's why the law was amended to enable to do so. It also needs to kind of become a one-stop shop for government services, where you could apply for your social grants or your NSFAS funding or CETA bursaries, where you could go and apply for your UIF compensation or apply for your ID documents, because it has a unique footprint, almost 800 branches still, across townships, rural areas, ones which are often far from government departments. And, you know, if you can occupy that niche space, then it can play a wonderful role. But also government institutions must give it support as well and utilize its services too.
Let's talk about government support in just a moment. But you rightly raise the modern economy. It's a digital and courier-driven economy. I need to ask you if you really think the post office is one against that backdrop, actually a viable business, given that there are other competitors that are streets ahead. Has the post office simply not left this too late?
We think it still has a space, because you're right. I mean, the private query companies are, doing very well, but they tend to be focused on urban centers. You will not find them in rural areas of Limpopo or the Eastern Cape, but you will have people living in those villages, those rural towns, those communities, those townships, who have relatives who work in the cities, would want to exchange parcels with them. You have in these very same communities, a desperation, a need for access to government services. So we think if the post office could follow those two models, it can actually do quite well. You're never going to WhatsApp a parcel. Your niece is always going to need to courier textbooks, etc., to her students and so forth. Home Affairs is going to need to courier ID documents from Pretoria to its branches and so on. But it also means that the post office has got to get its act together. It's got to ensure that its parcels are safe and secure. They won't have pilferage at its branches. They've got to deliver timely, because if you don't do that, then it's not going to attract the customers that it needs to grow.
Back to government, which has not delivered the full funding required. Hasn't the post office, Matthew, effectively been set up to fail?
We think there's validity in that argument, and it almost generally becomes like a catch-22. The BRP administrators asked for 3.8 billion rand. They showed PowerPoints, here's a 10-round plan. We didn't see much action out of them besides retrenching thousands of staff and closing hundreds of branches, and thus further shrinking its customer base and space to recover. Treasury said, look, we can give you money. It's maybe not as much as you want because of the fiscal pressures and the many legitimate demands on it, but they wanted to see a credible turnaround plan. So it almost becomes a catch-22. But the victim then becomes the post office, the workers at it, the customers of the post office. And so for us, our engagements with the ministers is that find the middle ground, do so quickly. You don't have endless or unlimited time. You need to find a solution. But we don't think you can be a country which just simply has no postal service. And again, we think there is space to rebuild it. South African Airways has shown you can fix something which was in the ICU.
And when you engage with the minister, are you satisfied with the response?
We're satisfied that whether you talk to the Minister of Communications, Minister of Finance, they're all, committed to finding a plan. But I think we're kind of stuck in that, middle ground where no one takes the first move. Treasury complains, where's the turnaround plan? Post office, or the communication ministry, says, where's the financing, etc. So we need to kind of move out of that logjam and to give her the support. But we're not convinced by the capacity of the BRP administrators. We think they've been there for 3 years. They have failed to make any real progress. Yes, I think your point is right about being set up for failure in terms of not giving the financial resources, but we think they could have done better. And if they had done better, they could have convinced Treasury to give them that support. But I think from our side, we have to do something quickly, and the status quo isn't a recipe for success.
And the problem is time is running out. You talk about the logjam and someone having to make the first move, but at this point, it doesn't look like anyone wants to do that.
That's the scary part. The fact we're having this discussion for 3 years, and even before then, the post office was in deep trouble, and we're not seeing sufficient speed. And again, you've got to move quickly because you're right. The other competitors are fulfilling that space whilst things take forever to fix at the post office. And eventually you'll come to a point in time where there's no space to fix it. But we're hopeful that it can be done. The fact that the Post Bank yesterday finally secured its licensing approval from the FFCA so it can become a fully registered bank gives you hope. But again, that is an issue that the Post Bank was busy with for more than a decade. So government's got to learn to move much faster if it really wants to compete in this economy and if it really wants to turn things around.
And Matthew, just a quick answer to your constituency. You warn about job losses. Surely it's becoming more difficult to justify continued taxpayer support for failing SOEs in spite of the fact that people will inevitably lose jobs if nothing happens.
I think first it's a bit of a balancing act. We've seen huge amounts of job loss at the post office already, but we think this institution can be fixed, and we've seen other examples of state institutions being fixed. We understand the point of Treasury that they can't just do endless bailouts, especially ones which are a blank check. There has to be a turnaround plan linked to it. We would agree with that. But I think for us, it's now about having the turnaround plan and also having the financial support. But even, Jerry, besides just financial support, if government institutions can utilize the post office for their postal needs, that can give it significant support. If state institutions can utilize the post bank for the banking service provider of choice, as opposed to going to the big five private banks, that can give you kind of an anchor tenant, so to speak, and really enable it, to give the kind of liquidity and the support for it to kind of get off the ground and to take off. But then the obligation also is on the post office and the post bank to ensure their systems are working, that they can deliver upon the mandates. Otherwise, government itself also has obligation it has to honor too. So you saw, for example, last year, SASSA had to move away from the post bank because the post bank didn't fulfill its obligation. So they also have to get the house in order if they really want to win over the state too as a key anchor tenant as well.
Going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Matthew Parks, Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, here's a worrying statistic. 9 out of 10 South African children I read with mental health conditions are simply not getting the care they need, a gap that experts are now calling a human rights crisis. And I think the question is no longer whether the system is under strain, but whether it's fundamentally failing the country's youngest citizens. Someone with a strong view on that, and she has been on the program with us before, is Professor Renata Skuman, Head of Healthcare Leadership at the Stellenbosch Business School. Renata, a very warm welcome. And what's your assessment of the reason here? Is it a funding crisis primarily, or simply a failure of setting the right priorities?
It's a bit of both. It's chronic underfunding and neglect of mental health care, which is a failure to protect constitutional rights, dignity and well-being of children and adolescents. So it's a policy problem, and it's also a priority problem, and it's a money and resource problem.
If it's a policy problem, let's go there first. How did we end up with so few specialists in such a high need area?
There's multiple layers of problems there as well, and it's always difficult to identify one thing. The one thing is there's often not opportunities locally or better opportunities abroad. Because the system is under so much strain, the people are also doing more than what is reasonably possible. Now, if you try to think that we have 40 child and adolescent psychiatrists in the country in both the public and private sector, the workload is impossible. So instead of having trained more specialists in the field and having positions available, there's positions frozen. There's not specialist posts available. There's not funding to train people. And then the people that are trained prefer to leave South Africa and go to other areas where they are maybe better supported and where there are better resources.
So if 90% of children are not getting the care they need, what are the consequences?
We know that that not only increases their risk for comorbid mental health disorders, but it limits their educational attainment, it limits their functional ability as an adult, it leads to excessive strains on families and relationships, but children just fail to flourish and develop to their full potential.
And this can also have dire long-term economic consequences for the economy, surely?
Absolutely, because we know that 70 to 80% of people with untreated or undiagnosed ADHD eventually develop, for example, anxiety, depression, other disorders, for example, substance use disorders as well. And we have had conversations previously of the impact on the economy of the stress-related conditions like anxiety and depression, which South Africa is, in any case, also not looking good. One of the fundamental problems that we also have is that our system is actually a sick care system, not a healthcare system. And that is why there's such a huge strain on human and financial resources. And perhaps this is one of the issues that really need to be highlighted, that we need to shift from a medicalized sick care approach to a preventative healthcare approach.
And how do you do that?
One of the examples that we should do is to integrate with social services and leverage schools potentially as primary settings for screening and early intervention. And then also together with that, and this is a big opportunity for us as well in South Africa, is to really address the social determinants of mental health, such as poverty, violence, and then also the access to education, access to recreational facilities. All of those things also decrease the pressure on mental health that we have But because we can intervene early, we prevent then the burden on only the Department of Health. It's not something that can be addressed in isolation.
But you can't do any of that unless you have the money. It would seem to me that's not available given the competing priorities that we have in this country.
There is a real lack of financial resources, yes, but there's also an unreasonable drain on resources that's allocated to health that end up in administration or contracts. And I'm careful in terms of this, but we know that there's a lot of mismanagement of funds as well. And then also where funds are then prioritized in, I want to say, when it's too late, when we have complications or only hospital-based care, why not shift that funds to primary health care and equip resources, mental health sisters, teachers, to provide the support for children? And then also a very big opportunity is for public-private partnerships and also to tap into the resources of NGOs and support the NGO world better.
I'm glad you raised the private sector. What role does the business community have to play in this equation? How does it need to step up?
It is so important. We have these discussions of corporate mental health or occupational health. We talk about employees, but we need to understand that an employee is in a family. An employee might have children or parents, but especially if we think that we potentially, if we can enable our employees to have better access to healthcare, it can spill over into their families as well. I do think there's a lot of restructuring that can happen. And a couple of years, we did a study in terms of the potential impact. If you look at different types of funding through different types of medical schemes or medical funding through corporate sectors as well. So there can be a lot of education. There can be making it possible for people to access care, whether it is time off to take a child to a clinic or take a child to a provider, or there can potentially be employees that can contract with NGOs to deliver mental health care services to their employees and not necessarily then having to go to the public sector or the Department of Health. That adds to that strain there.
All predicated, of course, on whether the business community has the appetite to grab this challenge, and perhaps it doesn't.
That is true. I think it would be sad if business people can't see the bigger picture. I think often the corporate environment and the business sector people have the ability to see systemic issues maybe more than a professional that's only in one specific area of the world. I often find that mental health care professionals or medical professionals only work in a silo instead of thinking of collaboration with education, etc. Where corporate or business people have that potential where they can see it maybe better, and they also can move like nimble ponies, not like a big elephant that a public healthcare sector often is, or a public sector department. But if we think in terms of the implications, where we say if your employees function better and the productivity that's associated with it, but also there's succession planning. Your current employees is not going to be your future employees. And what if we can have a society where children are better nourished, they are more resilient and resourceful, they can grow up to be resilient, resourceful adults that can either create employment or be gainfully employed themselves.
I like that analogy, more ponies and less elephants. Professor Renata Skuman, thank you very much indeed, Head of Healthcare Leadership at the Stellenbosch Business School. And that is our program for today and, in fact, for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.